afternoon. So last time, I believe Professor Campbell started by finishing covering write X or execute. So this idea that we don't need to make our writable memory executable. There's actually a lot of names that are mentioned in the slide, but it's all the same idea that if we can set memory non-executable, then we kind of prevent the most straightforward avenue for attack we've seen, which is we write shell code. And if we write shell code, it has to be written somewhere in the memory to run and then executed. So if we just ensure that most programs don't have memory that is both writable and executable, this seems to prevent a lot of attacks that involve shell code. All attacks that involve shell code, except for programs which, you know, somehow violate that property. And we mentioned that this idea was like slower to deploy than you might think because of the history that, well, there were ways programs and libraries deliberately took advantage of writable and executable space. And because the hardware support for this feature, you know, came relatively late. It didn't come until the 2000s, even though the memory protection, the read-only idea was around for much longer. And then you talked about address space layout randomization. So here, our goal is to prevent attacks that involve knowing addresses. So in a lot of our attacks, we wrote an at-memory address somewhere in our attack input. And the idea of address space layout randomization is, well, if the attacker doesn't know where things are in memory, then they can't do that attack. And so the idea is we just load things at random addresses in memory. And we learned that, well, when I say random address, we can't just choose any random address. We have a bunch of restrictions that are going to make it so that this idea isn't foolproof. So one of those restrictions is that, you know, some of the bits of our address are going to be effectively fixed. That because our memory for protection purposes is managed in these pages, generally we're going to keep things, you know, as whole pages aligned to the multiple of the page size, which means that the lower bits of the address generally won't be changing. They'll be fixed in our program, even with ASLR. And in 32-bit systems, this means we might have very few bits actually to tweak the address without running out of space. Because, like, the way we're getting the ability to choose random addresses is we have a bunch of unused space and we can put our little bit of data anywhere in that unused space. If we don't have much memory space overall, if our addresses are small, that's not a very useful strategy. And we were using 32-bit systems for a lot of the early deployment of ASLR on desktops and laptops. We also have this issue that we have these references within executables and libraries to other things in the executable and library. And typically these are relative. And typically, you know, that means that we have to load the whole executable all at once or the whole library all at once. We can't load them in separately randomized pieces. And this means that if we learn the address of one part of an executable, we can infer the addresses of everything else that's loaded from that executable. Or similarly, if we learn the address of one thing on the stack, we can figure out, well, based on how the program works, where is everything else on the stack? And so this means that information leaks really give us a whole lot of information. By information leaks, we just mean any time where you accidentally output a point. And, you know, common ways of doing this by accident are using uninitialized memory or something like that. You accidentally allocate a pointer. And that ends up giving the attacker all the information they need, even if that pointer isn't to the thing the attacker actually wants the address of, but it's just something related. And it can be very loosely related, like anything on the stack will get you the addresses you need for stack smashing. As long as you know, like, where it is relative to other things, and you can probably figure that out by, like, reproducing the same thing you did in the debugger. Anything, you know, in the program's global variables will give you the address of the procedure lookup table, because that's a fixed offset, and all those things that were useful for some other targets we had for using doing memory writes. And finally, we're going to finish up this topic. We talked about the other kind of obstacle to deploying this ASLR is that there's a real cost to it. That it seems like it's kind of free. If we have to load the data, it shouldn't matter what address we choose. And as far as loading it into memory, that's basically true. But the problem is, to make it possible to load our programs at random places in memory, we need to write our machine code differently. And this means that some machine code is going to become more complicated and therefore slower, and also probably bigger. And this is kind of scary if you're telling application writers, hey, I'm going to protect your program from these bugs that you don't think you have, and I'm going to make your program slower to do that. But it's not always a very convincing story to people. So questions about things we covered last time? Okay, so before I move on to talking about the cost of position-independent code, some notes on assignment stuff. So it seems that a lot of people had issues with the first strategy in the assignment and various issues with either conflicts on the stack or alignment. So the conflicts on the stack are people were doing something where they had their shell code and some strings that were important, and the return address was here. And then they call the function, and that function is going to push stuff on the stack here, and that makes their strings not get output very well. And I guess my thought for the future is maybe I'll reorganize the strategies, because this is tricky to debug even though we address it in the assignment. The other thing that came up is that, as is mentioned in the hints, but maybe was a little not clear enough at how important it is. The calling convention for x86-64 requires that the stack pointer, when you enter a function, be on a return address that is at a, this here needs to be a multiple of 16. So mod 16 needs to equal 0. And printf, on portal, takes advantage of this, because there are instructions that require one of their operands to be a multiple of 16. This is probably something which changed from the last time I gave this assignment, where the older version of printf that students mostly were using did not do this. So that's another reason I'll probably just reorganize the strategies, because even though the second strategy is harder to write the assembly for, it's easier to debug. Based on what happened, that's probably a good trick. Also, my impression is that a lot of people had trouble with the assignments, because I was testing my autograder Saturday night, and there were not the number of submissions I expected. Not close, so. So I'll take assignment Q&A generally. Yeah. Is the write-up still tentative? It is not, sorry. It is not meant to be tentative. I will mark that assignment as, we'll go to here. I will at some point mark that as not tentative, but it's not meant to be tentative. Can't do that quickly. Okay, but yes, it should be ready to use. Okay, other questions? Yeah.
Yeah, the assignment only seemed to work in portal 1 to 4. And after that, it will run in portal 1.
It would be nothing. So, you say the assignment only seemed to work in cipher machines. So we're always running the setarc command. That is the main way I see this happening. And what happened when it didn't work?
So it'll just say, I think, thank you, and then there'll just be no name. And then I think you should get a grade up, and then there are a bunch of question marks.
Okay.
But if you run it in portal 1 to 4, it'll just do it.
Okay, so the primary way I've seen this happen is, so the strings that you're inputting aren't getting there. So my primary concern with that is some people I saw inputted the strings in a, computed the address of the strings in a very fragile way. So like if you hard coded the addresses of those strings, that means if the stack differs by 8 bytes for any reason, you get a different result. So that's my guess as to what was happening. I need to look at your specific scenario. So the way to avoid that is to compute the address of the strings in a way where you don't like hard code the actual address. And one idea for that is you put it next to the shell code and you use a relative LEA with RIP to get its address. But that's my guess as to what was happening. So the stack was in a slightly different location, but not different enough that your NOP sled didn't get hit. And if you hard-coded the address, it would just be off because of very minor differences in the environment, especially if you weren't running the env command. It was. But even if so, like very minor differences in the environment would be enough, right? If the stack is off by 8 bytes, you lose. Does that answer your question? Yeah. I haven't checked. It's possible portals 1 through 4 and 5 through 12 have different libc versions or something like that. That could be another thing that's going on. And well, I expect that to be a case if we had this problem. So the other thing is don't put your strings next to your where your stack pointer is. So the way we recommended avoiding this is that your shell code should move the stack pointer from here to like here to prevent that from happening. But with different libc's, right, we'd expect possibly different things, right, amount of stuff written to the stack, which would also be a way that you could have that difference. Does that answer your question? Strategy two is like easier, is more consistent because it doesn't rely on anything the C library is doing. On the other hand, you're not reusing code from the SQ. And I think a bunch of these are probably cases where it's the things the C library is doing, or it's your hard coding addresses that are very fragile. I would say if you're using a NOP sled, you want to use all relative addresses because the purpose of using the NOP sled is you don't know exact addresses. So other questions? Comments? Okay, so that's on assignment stuff. Yeah, so I will, yeah, sorry.
I was gonna ask a question about the quiz.
Okay.
Question one, I was curious why a C wouldn't be.
C was the option where you, it would make it less likely that it was written to the stack.
Yeah.
There's 100% chance the stack canary is written to the stack, regardless of which strategy we use. Because the way the stack canary works, right, is when the function starts, we write it to the stack. Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
Other questions? Okay, so last time I believe Gamble went over like this idea that, you know, we normally would have a bunch of absolute addresses, and instead we might use code like this, where we had a bunch of extra instructions, just to deal with the fact that we don't want to hard code addresses here in order to make it so we can load this code in anywhere in the memory. And this is, in fact, what you'll see GCC do for certain types of switch statements. And it will generate different code for the two cases. So we kind of ended up replacing what would be one instruction with four. And this is the story on 64-bit FC6. And for this, this is a concern, but we don't have switch statements that need a jump table very often. The jump table lookup isn't like super efficient. Like it's not like an add we're making slow. It's something that hasn't happened very often, is not super fast because it involves a memory access. So this doesn't seem so bad. But a lot of this history of why ASLR took a long time to get adopted is that 64-bit FC6, the instruction set, was designed with the idea that we want position independent code in mind. And 32-bit FC6 very much was not. And we can see that by looking at what 32-bit FC6 code looks like on Linux when we turn on and off position independent code. So even basic things, so here is the stub for calling printf, and in my fixed address version, I just do a global offset table lookup with a constant address. Why am I not doing the thing we saw with 64-bit? We would do jump some offset of RIP. Why aren't we doing that? Because that instruction does not exist in 32-bit x86. There's nothing equivalent to that as one instruction. So what they've done here instead is that we set have require before you run this stub, EBX is set to the address of the global offset table, basically, or something near the global offset table, and we do an offset from that. And that means we can't use EBX for other things, and 32-bit x86 only has 8 general purpose registers, so we're down to 7. One of those registers is the stack pointer, we're down to 6. This is not good for performance. And there's our puts. And it changes the call, so you can see here that what was previously this nice, simple piece of assembly, instead, the way that works is we have this little function to set EBX that uses the return address to figure out where to set EBX. And then some offsetting from that. So we get the address basically of our current function by calling this little function, because this is the return address on the stack that we're reading. So this is the return address into EBX. We add to the return address to get an address in a particular place in our executable where our global offset table lives. And then we have this hard-coded address here that needs to turn into an offset from the EBX we computed. And then to call puts, we've set EBX, which it needs for the call. And also, and this is just how we pass the argument. In 32-bit x86, arguments are usually passed on the stack, not in registers. So you can see we turned a 2-instruction call into basically 6 instructions, some of which we might reuse, but this is pretty bad. So this is a pretty big cost and a big reason why ASLR adoption was kind of slow. Another sort of cost of ASLR is we mentioned vtables. So if I have this I have it labeled as struct. We can call this a class if that makes more sense to you. A class with a method that needs a vtable entry. We need to fill in that vtable entry with the address of the function. But that address with ASLR should be chosen dynamically. So how do we make that happen? Well, we give the linker extra work to do, the dynamic linker, the one that loads our program, extra work to do. So in addition to filling in our global offset table entries, we're also going to fill in the vtable. And we don't have to fill in the vtable in the version that doesn't have position independent code. And this is pretty minor for this example where there's only three entries in the vtable, but if we think of a big program with hundreds of classes, yeah, this is something. Some questions? And since we talked about positioning the parent code, I mentioned the options for producing it that you might see in the compiler, some of which, if you've taken CSR2, you've seen one of these. So there's the FPIC option, generates code for a library. And there's FPIE, which generates positioning the parent code for an executable. And I'll talk on the next slide about how are these different. Like, why is the code we need in a library different than the code we need in an executable? And these control the assembly that's generated. To control how the executable is linked, we have this PIE option says make it position-independent program, and the no PIE says make a non-position-independent program, and these days PIE is the default because we want to do ASLR all the time. And also this means instead of FPIE is the default. So as for, like, what's the difference between this library position independent code and non-library, we can see an example here with this function which returns a global variable. With a library, we have this problem that this global variable might be defined in a different library. And that library, we don't know where it is relative to other things. So we need to look up the location of that global variable in the library's global offset table. Whereas in an executable, what we'll do is we'll decide that this variable lives in the executables part of the global variable space. And therefore, we'll just look up, just choose a location in the executable for the global variable to live. But in the library, we can't do that because we don't know where the library that actually defines it is. And we can't elect to say, it's going to be in this library, because if something else defines it, that's a conflict. Some questions about my pick. I see. So I promised to talk about costs. So here's a example of what the costs look like on 32-bit x86. So this is running a series of benchmarks called SPEC CPU 2006 that's commonly used by processor and compiler makers to say how good they are. And we have the percent overhead, the percent slower things are with position-independent executable mode on. So the nicer one, slightly nicer one than the position-independent mode. And this is using a compiler with two different optimization levels. So this is optimized code. And you can see, depending on the benchmark we're running, you know, we have different overhead, but it's like 10-ish percent. And so I think this is like a big reason why it took a while for ASLR to get deployed. Like, it's really hard to sell to people, hey, your program's gonna run 10% slower. But we're doing this just in case you have a buffer overflow in it. We're going to run the whole program 10% slower. Also, you have to recompile. And we can see for some programs, it's like a lot more than 10% slower. So this might be a much worse story if we're talking about something actually computationally intensive. Questions? So for 64-bit, it's a lot better. I didn't find, when I last looked this up, very good like results, but it's, you know, the overhead's like 2 to 3-ish percent. So it's not nothing, but it's a whole lot better. And this is because we have instructions with, you know, RIP and 64-bit. We do not have instructions with the 32-bit equivalent of EIP. those don't exist in 32-bit x86 because they didn't have the foresight to design the architecture that way. And there are probably some other architectures that have this problem, right? This is an instruction set design issue where if you didn't think, oh, people are going to want to write position independent code, well, now you make all the programs that do that a lot slower. Questions. And so because of this overhead, it took a surprising amount of time for this to be kind of adopted by default. So in Microsoft land, Visual Studio 2010 was where it first became default. Before that, it wasn't. In OS X, it was the 10.7 version, the 2011 version where it was default. Before that, it was not. And in Linux, it's varying types of later, with it being able for more sensitive programs where they were, you know, said, well, you know, for sudo, it's worth enabling, even if it makes sudo slower, we don't care. But it was enabled there. So this is the story of like why ASLR is a nice, simple, pretty elegant idea. This is why it wasn't just the default forever. Questions? Anything with ASLR? Okay, so we're gonna talk about something that's most related to our write X or execute topic. And we're gonna talk about an extension of what we talked about earlier, which is arc injection, where we said, oh, we're gonna, instead of writing the shellcode, we're just gonna point to the system function. And that system function does everything the attacker wants to do. And we're going to, you know, talk about kind of a more general version of this idea called return-oriented programming, where basically the idea is we're going to find a chain of machine code that's already in the executable or its libraries that does what the attacker wants to do. And to give an example of this, I'll start with so something that's not quite returning programs, going to show us the concept. And this is something from someone's proof of concept from 2021. So F5 is a company that makes load balancers, which based on their security record, you might not want to buy. So load balancers meaning that this is a box which sits in front of a bunch of web servers and divides up the traffic between the web servers. And they had a stack buffer overflow, and for some reason in 2021 they didn't have ASLR or WriteX or execute enabled on their executables. Just turned off. But the stack address was randomized. This seems like a real problem. We can't do stack smashing. How are we going to attack this? So here's a tweet from 2021 with a proof of concept. So we can see here that we have, the idea here is that this is something that's returned by a server that's behind the load balancer that does the buffer overflow. And the way it does the overflow is we have an HTTP header with a bunch of A's. This is 892 A's, then 70 B's, and then something special that overwrites the return address. So this is where the return address that's overwritten is. And what do they overwrite the return address with? Well, they overwrite it with the address 0xC8 E5C3, which happens to contain, if you disassemble it, jump star RSP. Very convenient. And RSP happens to point here, so here they put their shellcode. we're returning to jump to the RSP, and happens that below that on the stack is our shell code. In this case, their shell code is a bunch of debugger interrupts. It's just a proof of concept. They just want to prove they're executing code, so they're executing the run the debugger thing, which will just crash the program. But crash it with, like, debugger trapped, so you know it actually happened. And so we have this idea here, and the big idea we have is that we have this gadget here. So we talked about gadgets already briefly, talking about, like, write gadgets. So this jump RSP is this convenient gadget that we're going to run that's going to help the attacker do what they want to do. In this case, we want to execute code from somewhere else, but we don't want, want to get the address right. This code happens to handle converting that address to jump into it by reading it from the stack pointer. So we don't have to figure out what the stack pointer is. It just jumps to it for us. Questions about what this exploit for proof of concept is doing? So you might say, if you're thinking about this a lot, you might say, well, wait a moment, this here, that's a really weird piece of assembly. Like, what the heck are we doing jumped RSP for? Right? That's never a thing we actually want to do in a real program that's compiled normally, because, like, we don't normally write code to the stack and run it. And if we do so, we probably don't have it at the very top of the stack. So why was this in this executable? And I don't have a copy of this version of F5's binary, but let's search for that same instruction in something else. In this example, we'll look at bin bash. And I found it. You might say, well, no, that's a move instruction. Move, you know, this is object dump is telling you that's a move. Well, it is a move. But if we start here, it's a jump RSP. And it's executable because we normally run that move instruction. And this just kind of just naturally happens. We have these interesting instructions, some of which aren't intended, appearing in our executable code. It has to be executable because, you know, that's part of the program that gets run normally. And so there we end up with that instruction. And this happens with a lot of other useful patterns that just appear intentional or not in the code that we can find and use as an attacker. And it turns out there's a great variety, not just things like jump RSP, that happen all the time. So I'll do a little example of kind of a simpler case. We're going to, instead of just finding one of these gadgets, we're going to use kind of a couple of them together. And that's where the real innovation of so-called return-oriented programming is that we're not just going to find this one useful thing. We're going to find a bunch of kind of half-useful things and put them together to do what we want. So start out, we'll have our traditional buffer overflow, but let's say that we have, you know, write X or execute a name, so we can't do stack smashing. How are we going to deal with that situation? Well, you know, we're first going to figure out how to overwrite the program, overwrite our return address. We're going to find out, okay, we have our buffer, and if we advance by 0x6c bytes, we have our return address. And we want to overwrite that return address with something which will get us further along the way to doing our goal. And my goal for this exercise is going to be to, as my equivalent of the shell code, to write out to call put s, you have been exploited. So I'm going to try to do that. And to do this, I'm going to look for interesting code that already exists in the executable to run to do what I want. And for this example, I'm going to say, I'm not going to look in the executable itself because the executable is very small, doesn't have that much stuff. I'm going to look in libc. Libc is huge and has lots of stuff. And I happen to know where it's loaded. We'll just say, you know, in this case, because I've disabled ASLR, if we had ASLR enabled, we use an information leak and then proceed from there. Same idea. So once print out that message, calling puts, and I can look up where puts is in libc, but I can't just put that address replacing the return address, because if we just run puts, RDI is not set correctly. So what I'm going to try to do is I'm going to try to have something run set RDI and then run puts. So I need to find something that will set RDI and then go to puts somehow. And if I were writing shell code, you know, this would, you know, maybe not be, this is, I just write shell code and jump to it to do that, right? This is kind of what I'm trying to imitate. Here this code is wrong. It should be like that. So I'm trying to like imitate this shell code, but obviously there's no copy of this code in libc. But what can we find in libc? Well, one thing I want to find is a way of loading my string into RDI. And if I look carefully at the code in libc, I find this. That will load something from the top of the stack, which is something I know I can control as the attacker, the address of the top of the stack into RDI. And then call a function. So this would do what I want if I call it with the stack pointer pointing to my string and RAX set to the address of puts. But the question is, how do I set RAX to the address of puts? You know, so I can run this code, you know, by say overwriting my return address, but in that case RAX won't be set, so it will crash. But like this is the setup for just using this gadget. I can load the right value to RDI, but then I jump to the wrong place. So I need to fix RAX before I run this to jump to the right place. So I'm gonna look for some code that lets me set RAX to the address of puts. And, well, if I look carefully at libc, I can find a way of doing that. Here is some code where if I read it from the right place, it says pop RAX, that loads a value of my choice into RAX. My choice, because I control what's on the stack. And then returns, so it jumps to somewhere else. And this is where the idea of return-oriented programming comes in. We're going to run the use this gadget and have it go to the other gadget by using return. So what's this going to do? This is going to actually read two addresses from the stack. It's going to read the address we're putting in RAX. Then it's going to read an address and jump to there, because that's how return works. And so we can write out something to the stack where we get this chain of operations. So what I'm going to write out, so I'm going to do my buffer overflow, and I'm going to replace the return address of vulnerable with a pointer to my pop RAX ret gadget. So when vulnerable finishes, it's going to return and run pop, you know, it's going to return, it's going to read that return address, and it's going to run pop RAX. That's going to take the address of puts and put it in RAX, and now, you know, our stack pointer points here. We're going to return, that's going to take the address of the pointer to the second gadget and jump there. And now our stack pointer points here. We're going to move that stack pointer value into RDI and call what RAX points to. And now we've kind of assembled that shell code that we wanted from these little snippets of libc. Questions about what's going on here. So we just found these two useful snippets of libc, and we can make one call the other because of how return works. And as we'll see later, like we can have more of these than two. If we just have a bunch that keep ending in returns, we can just keep having them go one after the other, after the other, after the other. Questions? Okay. So ROP, I guess I might talk about format strings later, but this kind of gives us kind of a mini machine language here. That we have a set of instructions that, if we find the right gadgets, include reading and writing values, include some flow control, include making system calls if we find anything that makes a system call. And we can kind of view this as kind of a virtual machine with a weird instruction set. And we can ask questions like, what's possible to do in this weird instruction set? And usually if you ask them, if you've taken DMT2, you know about like analyzing, are these languages like Turing complete or so on. You can find out, of course it is. So we can write programs that, instead of compiling them to shellcode, we compile them to these ROP chains, these chains of gadgets. Obviously, the process of compiling them to the chains of gadgets is a lot less trivial than compiling to our machine code where it's designed to be done. And here, this is kind of happening by accident. But this idea ends up being practical and, just as powerful in most applications. Like, obviously not guaranteed, but in most applications, this lets us do everything we could do with shellcode. So now that we know this concept, let's do an example here. So let's say I have my same setup. I have my buffer, and I have the first return address I'm overwriting. And my question is, what do I put here in order to make the program, when it does that return, run a sequence of things that ends in calling example with an argument of 0? What do I put on the stack? So we're going to start by, we can't just run example directly because RDI isn't set now. So we want to set RDI and then run example. So what do I put on the stack? What do I put in here to make that happen? I'll give you a few minutes, you can check with your neighbor, see if you agree on what should happen. And we have our toolkit of little instructions here that we're going to use to possibly accomplish that goal. And I will say there are multiple correct answers. Who'd like some more time? So I said there are multiple correct answers, so someone propose one answer. Let's see how many we can get. No volunteers for one answer. Or, well, yeah. Okay. So that gives us this solution, and I have kind of an illustration of what goes on. So we're going to first, this is going to be where our RSP initially points here. And that means that we're going to first run this pop instruction, which is going to make RSP, so RSP initially points there, then we return, and RSP now points to here, we pop that, and RSP points to here. We return to that address. RSP now points whatever's after this, which we didn't care about, though if we wanted to make example do something after it returned, we put something there. And then we run example. And if we're talking about how this looks in our stack layout, you know, remember this is increasing addresses. So if we think about our buffer, and then our first return address is going to be 100, and then we're going to have our 0x0, and then we're going to have our address of example. Yeah. If this is here, this is increasing addresses going up. Questions about how this works? So there's a second solution. Someone tell me a second solution. Yeah.
So you could put the address for the instruction that clears REI and then the instruction.
Yeah, so we can do run this XOR EDI EDI, which happens to clear RDI because when we write a 32-bit version of register, it modifies the 64-bit one. And then we can just run example right after that. That's another possible way of doing this. So questions? Here. And something I'd like to note is that a bunch of these like are kind of plausible things we would see. So like popping a register and then returning, that appears a lot of times in legitimate code. We don't need an accident to happen for that. Same with like setting EAX to zero, that appears a lot of times. EDI to zero, maybe less so, and then returning. But again, remember, a lot of these are happening because of kind of misparses of instructions. That's that, and the other one. Okay, so let's do a more interesting example. This one is a bunch harder. Check with your neighbor, see if you're doing what the strategy should be. Oh, I'm out of time. Okay, so I guess we'll go over this next time. So the key idea, so yeah, I'll go through the solution to this next time, but the key insight is that we can use this to write our string to memory, and the global variable is a fine location to do that, and then we can pass that memory address to system. And as far as, well, if that writes to memory, how do we make that write where we want to write? We just, same way we've seen before, we said RDI and RAX first before running that, and then, so we'll look, go in more detail through the solution for this, but the idea is that this lets us write binsh to the global variable, and then we pass the global variable to system. And we have all the tools we need to do that. We can load RDI to set the argument. We can load RAX, so we can use this little gadget to write to a memory location. And then we can eventually call system. That's where I'll leave it for today. And we'll review this next time.